Hi, my name is Lowell, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser Campus Radio.
Would you give me a beat?
CJSF 90.1 FM is the campus radio station for Simon Fraser University, located on Burnaby Mountain in BC, Canada. CJSF 90.1 FM, diverse, independent, yours. Check us out on SoundCloud or at cjsf.ca.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, mobile phones. Smart, incredibly useful, life support systems. They're also mobile petri dishes.
When you eat with your mobile phones, so many people having their coffee or their Egg Benedict in the morning with their platform just next by, and the microbes are absolutely happy. So not only it's heated, but you give them like almost a free buffet.
And the roots of the U.S. anti-abortion movement, misogyny, racism, hatred toward immigrants.
People are recognizing that this is happening in the 19th century. There's lots of nativist fears, there's anti-immigrant sentiment, and there's this sense that if white Protestant Americans do not pick up the pace of having babies, we're going to be overrun by non-white ethnic groups. And so very much rooted in racism and even ideas about eugenics.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. Guess what? Mobile phones are covered in germs. Duh. You talk into them, you spit on them, you touch them with hands you've just sneezed or coughed into, you take them into the toilet. The GPM spoke about the dark, dirty side of smartphones with Lottie Tajuri. Tajuri is an Australian researcher who knows just how contaminated mobile phones are and how you can clean them. It's interesting that people use their smartphones all the time. The smartphones are almost like life support systems for human beings. They're constantly in people's hands. And I like to look around on the train or on the street or in restaurants, and people have smartphones in their hands all the time. Do you have statistics? I know you do, on how many times people touch their smartphones in the course of a day?
Look, as you said, to my view, mobile phones are actually third hands. And yes, we touch them so many times a day. To tell you a bit of stats, between 2,000 and 5,000 times we touch our mobile phones in a day. And we will be using those platforms. And yes, they are very good. They are microcomputers. We can get so many communications. We can watch whatever movies. I mean, I understand the value of it. But we use them now more than 3 hours and 15 minutes a day. And in some country like Brazil, it's more than 5 hours a day.
So you were saying that people typically touch their smartphone between 2,000 and 5,000 times a day.
Absolutely. So you understand, you can actually do some SMS, you can write on WhatsApp, etc. So you are constantly touching those platforms. And the big problem, the huge problem, is that, as I said, those platforms are your third hand that we never sanitize, that we never wash or clean. And the problem is that those platforms are in some way five-star accommodation hotels for microbes, because we never wash them. We deposit microbes with our hands all the time. And this is a huge concern, because those mobile phones are actually electronic platforms that make those microbes thrive because of the conditions. You know, you switch on your mobile phone, you give some sorts of temperature control for those microbes to thrive. When you eat with your mobile phones for your breakfast, lunch, you've seen so many people having their coffee or their Egg Benedict in the morning with their platform just next by. And you have there you deposit some food on those platforms and the microbes are absolutely happy. So not only it's heated, but you give them like almost a free buffet all the time when you go and eat. And on top of that, when you talk over your mobile phone, you actually spit out in some way some salivary droplets, and that give moisture to those microbes to also thrive and grow. So that is a huge issue. And our research has found that there is a huge, absolutely huge spectrum of different microorganisms. You name, of course, viruses, bacteria, but you have as well fungi. And you also have protozoa parasites on those platforms.
And people take their smartphones into the toilet.
Absolutely. And those are the studies that we did actually in the community, but as well in hospitals. And I'm talking about healthcare workers as well. Like more or less around 50 to 60% of the individuals that we actually surveyed actually use their mobile phones in the toilets, in the bathroom. And that is another huge concern, because you end up having here, of course, some fecal-based contaminations that end up being on your mobile phone. And you talk about microbes, for example, E. coli we found. We found Campylobacter, we found Salmonella, we found Listeria, we found Clostridium difficile. I mean, it is incredible. And I'm talking about viable microorganisms. So this is a kind of habit that we do really wrong. And you can understand those habits can have a huge consequence when we talk about, imagine yourself being served a dessert in a buffet where the food handler did use his mobile phone or her mobile phone and did use it inside the bathroom just before serving you. Same thing with healthcare workers. The healthcare workers, unfortunately, don't really fully know the problem. And this is the reason why our research here is trying to really strongly make an awareness of the issue, because those mobile phones that are contaminated are Trojan horse type of platforms. So we don't know that we carry the enemy with us. But having healthcare workers using as well mobile phones in the bathroom is a real concern. You know, most of the time, and of course, they will wash their hands all the time. The healthcare workers, many of us in the community and in other professional settings, we know that we can do something to control infection spread. Well, we wash our hands. The problem is that if you touch your mobile phone, which is contaminated and filthy, you cross-contaminate your hands all over again. What does it mean? Mobile phones negate hand washing.
Now, you were mentioning, Lottie, about the number of bacterial types that you find on mobile phones. But this is, I gather, this is an underestimate, because it's challenging. Not all microbes can be grown on standard cultures. It's difficult to culture everything. Take a swab of a smartphone screen and see how many bugs are growing, how many colony-forming units there are there. It's an underestimate. Can you talk about this?
Yeah, we did actually look at that. What we did was to actually also use, on top of culture type of experiment, but we did use a high technology called next generation sequencing. So we did a metagenomic analysis, meaning that we extracted the DNA of all those bugs that were from the swabs of those mobile phones. And by having this DNA, we did sequence all those bases, all those DNA nucleic acids, and it allowed us to find the signatures of all the viruses that were there on the mobile phone, all the bacteria, all the fungi, and all the protozoa. And on top of that, our research, which is right now the top number one, have looked at the amount of antibiotic-resistant genes that are on mobile phones. And we also looked at virulent factor genes. So what are virulent factors? As you know, those are kind of genes that will enhance a pathology if the microbe is pathogenic. We found a stack amount of microorganisms, as I said. Like, I'll give you an example. In 26 mobile phones that we swabbed in healthcare, setting in a hospital, we found more than 11,000 microbes. And we found more than 600 virulent factor genes, as well as kind of antibiotic resistant genes. So we have here mobile phones that are mobile petri dishes harboring a huge amount of microbes. And on top of that, those microbes are superbugs. And that is a huge concern, because in our pocket, we have mobile phones that we touch, as you said before, all the time. But on top of that, we might actually disseminate those bugs all around. And I'm going to give you an example about my fear is in the field of biosecurity. Imagine the amount of passengers taking, you know, modern transport like planes that are traveling all around the world from one part of the globe to the other part of the globe in matters of hours, while they actually travel with their mobile phones. We know for a fact that microbes stay alive on mobile phones for not hours only, not days only, but even weeks on your mobile phone. So you understand that when you land, like I think you're based in Holland right now, if someone lands in Holland, have you ever had a custom officer stopping the person and looking at the mobile phones and what is on mobile phones? And I tell you another analogy. Do you think that if you land in your country and you have, let's say, a real petri dish full of colonies, full of bacteria, I think the custom officer will not be happy with you. However, they let everybody come in with their mobile phones, but the mobile phones are actually mobile petri dishes.
And mobile phones are warm, of course. And so microorganisms, they don't just survive, they actually grow on smartphone screens.
Absolutely. And this is the reason why we say that mobile phones are breeding grounds for those microorganisms. And yes, the fact that we switch them on or we keep them in the pocket, they are warm. And the problem with that, by the way, is that this particular temperature is actually quite close to the body temperature. Like if you leave your mobile phone in your pocket, well, what does it mean? It means that actually your mobile phone might be a magnet of microorganisms that actually suitable for you to be infected with. So we actually carry with us not only the enemy, but a selected type of enemy that is going to be a very big harm on us.
You've written in your article, this is an article published in 2020, but perhaps there's something more recent, that there are no guidelines, well, guidelines in hospitals, in North American or developed world hospitals, there are no guidelines for the use of smartphones.
Absolutely.
And medical practitioners, they're using their smartphones for, I mean, smartphones are smart, they're great. There are all kinds of applications on smartphones that health professionals use to find out what drugs should be used, what are the counterindications, endless numbers of really useful applications on smartphones that really encourage health practitioners to have their smartphone in their hand while they're treating patients. And there are no guidelines. Can you talk about this? This is the guideline situation for the use of smartphones in hospital?
Look, indeed, you're right. I mean, if you look at the World Health Organization or the CDC, Center for Disease Control and Prevention, you don't see really a strong, let's say, emphasis on mobile phones used in healthcare settings. And indeed, I can tell you that in hospitals here in Australia, there is nothing at all. And this is obviously the same thing happening in other countries. And this is a big problem because you've been talking about hospitals. In hospitals, as you know, there is a huge amount of individuals that go there because they are obviously having health problems and they are immunocompromised. And if you have here a medical doctor or nurse that use their mobile phones without knowing that those mobile phones are actually real fomites, the real contaminated type of platforms, well, they might actually convey those microbes straight to the patients. And the patients will end up having these infections, which is called nosocomial disease, because you contracted this type of infection within the hospital. But the problem is Indeed, there is no regulations, implementations, legislations. There is nothing around this kind of, let's say, infection control against mobile phones. And the big problem, I think, is that the healthcare workers don't really fully know the issue that is around mobile phones. And that, I think, is a disaster type of recipe for immunocompromised individual. And I am certain, I mean, I haven't done that research yet, but I'm certain that mobile phones contribute to the hospital-acquired infections. I am absolutely certain. And if we sanitize mobile phones, if we use them in the 5 moments of hand washing that healthcare workers do really well, if we include that sanitization of mobile phones, I am certain that you will end up having less nosocomial diseases, less hospital-associated infections, and less pain for those patients.
Let me back up for a second. What kinds of microorganisms do we find naturally on our hands? Suppose I go wash my hands with soap and hot water. That's time zero. And then in the course of a day, I mean, I'm not constantly washing my hands unless I have some sort of psychological pathology, just normal set of hands, pair of hands that are touching things in the course of a day, you know, doing a cough into my hands rather than doing the elbow routine. What kinds of things are living on my hands?
Well, look, you have all sorts of normal biota that we have on our skin or like you mentioned about coughing in our mouth. You have Streptococci oralis, you have Streptococci sanguinis that you get to see in your buccal area. You have Staphylococcus epidermidis and even Staphylococcus aureus, which are part of the normal biota. But the problem with what I just said with the mobile phones and back to the healthcare setting, a patient that is immunocompromised, you don't want to get any type of infections towards that individual. What it means is a normal microorganism getting in the bloodstream of an immunocompromised patient, it's another recipe for disaster. I give you an example. When we, for example, did swabs in a neonatal intensive care unit in a hospital here in Australia, we found not only E. coli, but we found, for example, Bordetella pertussis, which is responsible for whooping cough.
On people's hands.
Yes, Streptococcus pneumonia. We found on those platforms, and that becomes an incredible dangerous, and at least a high risk that probably the public health authorities need to look at and the infection control staff look at. And I can tell you that those mobile phones, as you mentioned before, are used by everybody and gloves on for some, which is really worrisome for me.
How can one clean mobile phones?
Look, actually, it's interesting. You talk to me about the fact that you are from Canada. I am talking actually with some companies, some based from US, the USA, and some from Canada. And there is one company that is doing in, which is, by the way, based in Toronto, called Glissner, doing a particular device, which is a phone UVC sanitizer. And that sanitizer, which is quite interesting, there are many of them in the market, but this one is very interesting because it does the job of getting rid of those microbes in only 20 to 30 seconds. And even the last version I heard about does the job in 10 seconds. What does it mean? They use ultraviolet C. It's a device which is where you can slit in your mobile phone. So it's a touchless kind of experience. Your mobile phone gets inside the device and it is sanitized at a particular germicidal wavelength, ultraviolet C radiation. And what does it mean? Well, your mobile phone gets out of the device in 10 seconds. How great it is for the healthcare settings, it's fantastic because what does it mean? It means that healthcare workers can wash their hands as usual, like what the World Health Organization is asking them to do to prevent infection control. But in the same time, they can slit their mobile phone in that phone UVC sanitizer, which will be, by the way, cleaned in 20 seconds/10 seconds, which is amazing. That simultaneous way of cleaning your two hands and your third hand.
And how about, you know, ordinary people? Can you apply isopropyl alcohol to a smartphone?
Okay, I'm going to tell you a kind of personal venture that I went into. As soon as I had this issue with what I saw in that hospital back in 2014 for the birth of my daughter, I started to actually use alcohol wipes and disinfectant wipes. And the problem with this is that you get rid of a very important layer on top of your mobile phone. And what does it mean? It means that you get the oleophobic layer out of your smartphone. And what does it mean? You lose your tactile experience by actually wiping off your mobile phone. So I would discourage your readers or your listeners to do that, because you're going to damage your phone. The best way forward is to use efficient, robust, and fast ultraviolet C phone sanitizer that will be, by the way, not only available in healthcare setting, but as well in airports and also as well in your own house. So what I'm trying to say with our research with the mobile phones here is that why don't we sanitize mobile phones? Because we know mobile phones are third hand. We know that mobile phones are contaminated with heaps amount of different types of microbes. We know that mobile phones actually harbor superbugs. We should sanitize them to reduce at least the spread of those microbes, especially in vulnerable area, which is the hospitals, clinics, dentist practices, or GP practices. On top of that, very important that we sanitize mobile phones in airport, where billions of travelers are never stopped in our customs to actually, those mobile phones. So basically, what does it mean? We have also an issue of biosecurity, because you know what we found, David, on mobile phones? We found plant pathogens. We found animal pathogens. And what does it mean is that when people land to your beautiful country, Canada, and because the mobile phones have not been sanitized, they might actually introduce very, problematic type of plant pathogens to your country, or animal pathogens. And this is the reason why we also call not only for the public health authorities to look at the research we're doing, and we need their help because we want to do more research, so we need more funding, but we also ask the biosecurity officers and the authorities to really do their job a little bit further and zoom in what those mobile phones do harbor.
Lottie Tajouri, thank you so much for your time.
You're more than welcome.
Lottie Tajouri is Associate Professor of Molecular Genetics at Bond University in Robina, Australia. He's also a member of the Dubai Police Scientific Council. Read more about Lottie Tajouri's filthy mobile phone research at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Anti-abortion movement portrays itself as pro-life, pro-family, and conventionally conservative, whatever that may mean. Close to the surface, something darker bubbles, a wellspring of misogyny, racism, hatred toward immigrants, and antipathy for personal freedoms of all sorts. Among these, the freedom of a woman to control her own body. The GPM spoke about the history of women's reproductive rights with Lauren McIver Thompson. Thompson is an assistant professor of history at Kennesaw State University in Kennesaw, Georgia, and a historian of early 20th century women's rights and public health at Georgia State University College of Law's Center for Law, Health, and Society. I've been reading some of your writings, and you refer, Lauren Thompson, to false histories of abortion, and you write, quote, "Our ignorance of this history, of the history of abortion, and of women's reproductive health by extension, equips those in the anti-abortion movement with power to create dangerous narratives, unquote. How so? How are we ignorant of the history of abortion?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, there's a sense that, you know, if you ask the average person on the street, they think that abortion and birth control are something new. And so that, I think, positions people who have religious objections to birth control and abortion in very particular ways, because it allows them to say, look, this is a problem of modernity, and it's because our world today is so corrupt and immoral. But the truth is, obviously, you know, birth control and abortion go back to the earliest human societies. We know from, you know, ancient Egyptian archaeology, the kinds of contraceptives they were using. There's references to abortion all throughout the ancient world. And so this is not a new phenomenon, but I think that there's also the idea that, you know, in addition to it not being common in the past, that everyone was against it in the past, and that's why they outlawed it. And so that is not true either, because the physicians who were working to get the state laws that were passed in the 19th century were sometimes motivated by ideas that abortion was murder and therefore immoral, but they were also equally motivated by other things like anti-immigrant sentiment, racism, the idea that women should not be participating in politics in the public sphere, and therefore, you know, abortion was particularly immoral for women because it was having them neglect their duties of motherhood. And so there are a variety of sort of myths floating around about abortion history that I think are getting now incorporated literally into our court system, because they're getting these lies are getting incorporated into, for example, the Dobbs majority opinion that was issued last summer. I mean, Justice Alito says that the physicians who passed this law were motivated by the idea that abortion is murder and that life begins at conception. And he also says that, you know, if Americans really hadn't wanted to legalize abortion, they would have presumably voted against these laws in their legislatures. He conveniently leaves out the fact that women did not have the vote until 1920, and the vast majority of these laws were passed between 1850 and 1900. So there's really just sort of a variety of myths floating around that I think are really shaping our political discourse and even our judicial discourse about abortion.
And Justice Alito in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization refers to, and I pulled this from one of your articles, I haven't read the majority opinion itself, but he apparently refers to, quote, domestic supply of babies, right? Opposing abortion because it stands in the way of or interferes with the domestic supply of babies. And then he goes back to 13th century English case law.
Yes. I mean, first of all, for him to bring up the domestic supply of infants is, I mean, he's really fitting in there with the exact arguments that were made about or for outlawing abortion in the 19th century. Of course, physicians and ministers and reformers who were in support of passing strict abortion laws, again, wanted white Protestant native-born women to have more babies than they were having. There was a very steep fertility decline, you know, since about the Revolutionary War up through the early part of the 20th century. I mean, it was the average number of children that a family has drops from somewhere between 7 and 9 to somewhere between 3 and 4. And that's a pretty big drop. Overall. And so then by World War II, many families mostly only have 2 to 3 children. And so people are recognizing that this is happening in the 19th century, and they want, and there's lots of nativist fears, there's anti-immigrant sentiment, and there's this sense that if white Protestant Americans do not pick up the pace of having babies, we're going to be overrun by non-white ethnic groups. And so very much rooted in racism and even ideas about eugenics.
Let's come back to this, but how far back do your own historical studies go? I've been just scanning some of the literature, the popular literature, Scientific American amongst them, on the internet about the views that prevail.